Today is Tuesday, the 3rd of August, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Afghanistan's president says that he has a plan to counter recent Taliban offensives.
The president only shared broad details of his plan Monday. The military is to defend strategic sites. The police will safeguard the cities.
Plus, calls continue for more help to battle fires in Turkey.
The EU said it had helped mobilize 3 firefighting planes on Sunday.
We'll have these stories and more next. Afghanistan's president, Ashraf Ghani, announced on Monday that he has a clear plan to counter Taliban offensives across the country. As VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports from Islamabad, Ghani's government has been criticized for seemingly lacking a strategy.
Amid what appeared to be inexorable gains by Taliban forces, President Ashraf Ghani said a new security plan will quickly change the situation on the battlefield. Ghani says, I want to tell you that a clear plan is prepared for reaching stability in 6 months, and the implementation of the plan has started. Ghani spoke before a joint session of parliament. The president only shared broad details of his plan Monday. The military is to defend strategic sites. The police will safeguard the cities. Meanwhile, Afghanistan's intelligence agency, NDS, is to coordinate armed public uprisings against the Taliban. The United States is preparing to withdraw the last of its troops from Afghanistan by the end of this month. This has been America's longest-running war. After foreign forces started withdrawing from Afghanistan in May, militants made unexpectedly fast territorial gains. They now control half of all districts and several key international border crossings. Ghani has asked members of parliament to help mobilize the population in support of security forces. He says the Taliban will not engage in meaningful peace negotiations until the situation on the battlefield changes. In a statement following Ghani's address, Parliament reiterated its support for the country's democracy, human rights, including women's rights and freedom of speech. Ghani's address comes at a time when the Taliban have increased attacks on Afghan cities, besieging several of them simultaneously. At least 3 cities, Kandahar, Herat, and Lashkargah, have seen intense fighting over the last few days. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan Reconciliation, Zalmay Khalilzad, says the United States remains committed to promoting a political settlement between warring Afghans, stressing that neither side can win the conflict militarily. Ambassador Khalilzad gave a detailed interview to VOA's Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad via Zoom.
The first question I have is that, do you think the U.S. has a moral and political responsibility to ensure that Afghanistan does not slide into another civil war after the U.S. military departs, just like what happened after the Soviet Union's departure from Afghanistan in the 1980s, 90s?
It's a point that we have kept in mind, that what happened in the 90s should not be repeated, that working with the Afghans, we did something big, a huge sacrifice on the part of the Afghans with our support to get the Soviets out. And then we abandoned Afghanistan and a terrible war took place. And it produced challenges, particularly 9/11. So we do not want to repeat that mistake. That's why, although we could have left Afghanistan, we didn't need to have an agreement with the Taliban in principle to depart. But we engaged the Talibs as part of a strategy, a plan to have safe withdrawal of U.S. forces, yes, but also to start as a key package, start a peace process in Afghanistan that brings the Afghan war, a long, very long war, where there has been a lot of suffering, to an end. And the agreement with the Taliban provided the opportunity for Afghans to sit across the table from each other, a historic development, to reach an agreement, to agree on a formula that would have broad support in Afghanistan and international support as well. And unfortunately, the two sides have not taken advantage of that opportunity. We are always looking for ways and means to help accelerate the negotiations, because we don't see a military solution to the war in Afghanistan. There must be a political solution, a political agreement for a lasting peace. And we will stay with it. We're committed to staying with it until that that goal is achieved.
But aren't the Taliban violating the letter and spirit of the Doha agreement by this brazen military attempt to militarily conquer Afghanistan and use violence and targeted assassinations in their quest for absolute power?
The agreement necessitated, committed the Taliban to negotiations for a new Islamic government in Afghanistan and a comprehensive ceasefire. And there is this agreement. The government also has had challenges or difficulties in terms of agreeing to or embracing the idea of a new Islamic government. And the Taliban have used force to see if it could coerce the government into agreeing to a formula for a new Islamic government, a new constitution as they see it as well. There has got to be a political formula. The government cannot get rid of the Taliban. It's our assessment. And the Taliban cannot conquer Afghanistan and have a government that has the support of the overwhelming majority of the Afghans and international support. Maybe some Talibs think there is a military solution to the conflict, although they tell us otherwise. When they speak to us, the Talib says there is no military solution. But if some commanders or some military leaders think that, they are miscalculating, because there will be resistance. And even if they take over the country, there will be resistance. And there will be international opposition. They won't be recognized. They will not receive international assistance. They will become a pariah state, which they say they do not want. And the wise thing is for both sides to engage seriously. And
you have put in so much diplomatic effort in order to help Afghanistan have peace and stability. Do you feel let down by the two warring sides in Afghanistan?
Well, I am concerned very much by the lack of progress. I know that the gap has been large, continues to be a big gap between the two sides. But they need to put the leaders, the interests of the country first, rather than their own interest or their factional interest. There cannot be peace without compromise, without give and take, without respect for the fundamental rights of all Afghans, men and women, and the Afghans having a say, ultimately the people in terms of what happens to them. But for the short term, although those are things that in the long term will really be determinative, it is the responsibility of the leaders, because the people are at their, in a sense, at their mercy. And they both argue that they are people of God, and that they are fighting for a righteous cause. Well, there is nothing worse morally and otherwise than the innocent people getting killed. and killing innocent people. And innocent people are getting killed every day, unfortunately.
Zelmay Khalilzad is the U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan Reconciliation, and he was speaking to VOA's Ayaz Gul in Islamabad, Pakistan. The United States announced on Monday that it was expanding eligibility for resettling refugees from Afghanistan who may be at risk of Taliban retaliation due to affiliation with U.S. forces. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told reporters that the United States has a responsibility to help those who stood with Washington.
The first flight of Operation Allies Refuge arrived in the United States on Friday. The second flight arrived early this morning, together transporting around 400 people. And those flights will continue. We're now focused on relocating a group of more than 1,000 applicants and their families who have nearly completed processing, around 4,000 people in total. Additionally, we're pursuing third country agreements so eligible Afghans can be quickly relocated to wait safely in another country while we finish elements of this rigorous vetting process.
A State Department official said that the agency did not have an estimate for how many Afghans would be eligible to come to the United States under the expanded program. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Using buckets and water bottles, desperate villagers in Turkey's port city of Marmaris have stepped in to help contain the fires that are raging around them on Monday. Reuters' Emer McCarthy has that story.
With flames licking at their doorsteps, locals in the Turkish resort town of Marmaris have stepped in to take matters into their own hands. Walking up and down the hills ferrying water, the locals are angry that there have not been enough helicopters and planes used to contain the fires burning since Wednesday.
This cannot be done without aerial support, my friend. What can we do?
The Turkish government faced fresh criticism of its handling of the disaster on Monday. Firefighters have taken control of 125 of the 132 fires, with 16 planes and 51 helicopters tackling them from the air in an operation also involving some 850 firefighting vehicles and more than 5,000 personnel, according to the forestry minister. Their work was being hindered, though, as temperatures soared above 40 degrees Celsius, paired with strong winds and very low humidity of around 8%. Residents like Gulhan have now found themselves in the line of fire.
My friend, whoever is coming must come. For God's sake, for God's sake, this cannot work without a helicopter. What are we supposed to do, fly in the air? You see this? We are here as the entire village, from the locals to others. We didn't run away or anything, so the government must see this and also not run away. It must send some of its planes here.
The EU said it had helped mobilise three firefighting planes on Sunday, one from Croatia and two from Spain, after Turkey activated a disaster response scheme to request help from other European countries. President Erdogan's communications director rejected criticism of the government's handling of the situation. He slammed a social media campaign calling for foreign help for Turkey, describing most information about the fires on the platform as fake news.
Emer McCarthy of Reuters News. In the United States, the battle against the wildfires in the West continues as well. Associated Press correspondent Rita Foley has those details.
Nearly 22,000 firefighters and support personnel are battling 91 large active wildfires covering almost 3,000 square miles, mostly in western states. The largest is the Bootleg Fire in southern Oregon. Big wildfires are also burning in Montana, California, Washington State, and Idaho. Scientists say climate change has made the region much warmer and drier in the past 30 years, and they think it'll continue to make weather more extreme and wildfires more frequent and destructive. I'm Rita Foley.
A record number of migrants has crossed the English Channel this year from France to Britain in small boats. Henry Ridgewell reports that the British government is aiming to deter the migrants by making it a criminal offense to arrive in the country without permission.
Across the world's busiest shipping lane, in overloaded rubber dinghies, dozens or sometimes hundreds of migrants are crossing from France to Britain to seek asylum almost every day. This group was filmed a short way off the British coastline last month, apparently having rowed the 30 kilometres across the channel.
Where are you from?
Sudan.
Sudan. You have no engine?
We don't have engine, yeah.
You have enough water? You have something to drink?
No. Yeah. We just have a water here. We took it and...
The migrants come from many different countries in Africa, the Middle East and South Asia, most fleeing conflict or poverty. A record 430 people made the crossing in a single day last month. The total for 2021 so far stands at some 8,500, higher than the number for all of 2020. Speaking last month, Britain's Home Secretary said the government would take action to stop the migrants arriving.
What we're seeing right now, effectively people trafficking, smugglers, criminal gangs, exploiting our asylum system to bring in economic migrants and people that, quite frankly, are circumventing our legal migration routes, coming to our country illegally.
The spike in arrivals has embroiled Britain's revered sea rescue charity, the Royal National Lifeboat Institute, which has helped migrants at sea. Critics accuse the charity of providing a taxi service to Britain. The RNLI says it helps anyone in distress, regardless of who they are. The government is putting forward new legislation, which could see migrants who enter Britain without permission facing up to 4 years in prison. Bridget Chapman works at Kent Refugee Action Network, a charity supporting migrants arriving across the English Channel.
It flies in the face of international law. You know, the Geneva Convention states that people have a right to seek asylum, and it can be in a country of their choosing. It feels very deliberately punitive. It feels like saber-rattling. It feels like a lot of tough talk to make people feel that the UK is not a welcoming place. The fact is that that's not going to stop people from coming.
A committee of British lawmakers last week strongly criticised the living conditions for newly arrived migrants in the port of Dover, with refugee children seen sleeping on the floors of reception centres. The local Kent authority says it can no longer cope with the number of arrivals. At the same time, Britain has given France $75 million to beef up policing of the northern French coastline to try to intercept migrants, on top of $39 million given by Britain last year. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Polish authorities on Monday granted a humanitarian visa to a Belarusian Olympic sprinter in Tokyo. Krystyna Timanowskaya is seeking political asylum in Poland after she alleged that her team's officials were trying to force her to fly home to Belarus against her wishes. The political drama unfolded after Timanowskaya criticized how officials were managing the Belarusian Olympians, provoking a backlash in state-run media back home, where the government often cracks down on critics. Gymnastic superstar Simone Biles is planning to compete in the balance beam final on Tuesday at the Tokyo Olympic Games. Biles withdrew from the team all-around competition last Tuesday, citing mental health issues. Biles, talking about her decision to withdraw, said on social media that she was also suffering with the twisties, a condition in which gymnasts have trouble maneuvering in the air. The condition can be dangerous for the athletes. History was made at the Games Monday when New Zealand's Laurel Hubbard became the first openly transgender athlete to compete. Hubbard, who transitioned 8 years ago, was the oldest weightlifter in Tokyo, but no lifted in the women's 87-plus kilogram competition. She's eligible to compete under a 2015 IOC decision allowing transgender athletes to compete in women's events. Authorities in South Sudan's Unity State say at least seven people are reported dead after floods submerged several homes in Mendia County recently. Officials also say that the floods have displaced about 400 families. The floods destroyed infrastructure, houses, and the livelihoods of hundreds of people.
This is Science in a Minute.
Spare the rod and spoil the child is a popular proverb that some trace to the Bible. The saying has been used to encourage parents to spank their children when they misbehave. Over the years, the maxim and its suggested parental guidance have been discouraged by the mental health and parent support communities. A new Harvard-led study suggests spanking a child could have a harmful effect on the development of the child's brain in ways similar to more severe violence. Study senior researcher Katie McLaughlin, a professor at Harvard, says her team found children whose families use spanking as punishment are more likely to develop issues such as anxiety, depression, behavior problems, as well as other mental health problems. She adds that many don't think of spanking as a form of violence. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The U.S. official who wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning book on genocide is visiting Ethiopia this week to press the government to lift what the U.S. calls a blockade on humanitarian aid in the conflict-torn Tigray region. Samantha Power, an administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, hopes to meet with Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who has asserted that there is no hunger in Tigray. Ethiopian officials blame the aid blockade on rival Tigray forces, who have retaken much of the region. But a senior USAID official says that's 100% not the case. Analysts fear the war has opened on a second front, with the potential to worsen the humanitarian crisis in the region. For more, International Edition's Chinedu Afor spoke with Ali Vergi, senior advisor to the African Center at the U.S. Institute of Peace in Washington.
The war has become a two-front war. There is a western and southern theater on the border between the Amhara region and the Tigray region and leading towards the Sudan. And then there's a new front on the eastern side of Tigray towards Afar and Djibouti. And this is the new development. And there is fighting going on in the Afar region, which the new feature of this war.
Looks like the war is spiraling out of control, is it?
I don't know if it's spiraling out of control. It's only expanding, and that's because there are military objectives that Tigray People's Liberation Front and the Tigray Defense Forces have, and they've stated those. The government forces, or the federal government forces, backed by Amhara State and other states, are responding to that. And so for the moment, it's not out of control, but it's only expanding.
What are the possibilities that neighboring countries might be drawn into this conflict?
I think the possibility has always been there. Of course, Eritrean forces were involved from a very early stage of the conflict. The more that the war moves towards the west, the more it concerns the western neighbors, including Sudan. To the east is a little bit different because both Djibouti and Somalia don't really have significant forces to be involved. But certainly there's always been the potential for regional involvement.
The fallout of this war has fallen hard on refugees, and they are, depending on who you're listening to, counter claims of who is actually responsible. But the United Nations say the situation on the ground is really bad. What are your sources telling you?
I think the situation is getting worse. It's not only a matter of refugees. It's mostly a matter of people within the region of Tigray, many of whom are internally displaced. They may not cross an international border, but they're still in dire need of assistance. The World Food Programme has said that it's having great difficulty getting sufficient food into the region, and they are running out of supplies, and millions of people are dependent on those supplies. So it's certainly a deteriorating situation.
Reports indicate that Ethiopia is mobilizing and the Tigray people are also fortifying. Do you see an end to this?
I think both sides have been very clear about their mobilization. And this is obviously a very worrying sign in terms of the desire for restraint and looking towards ending the conflict. But ultimately, the solution is a political one, not a military one. And so whether there are new troops on the ground from either side, it will still require a discussion at a political level to find some sort of resolution. And I think that is still very much possible if both sides feel that they can actually engage in talks.
That was the U.S. Institute of Peace senior advisor to the Africa Center, Ali Vergi, speaking to International Edition host Chinedu Afor. Israel has become the first country to distribute a third dose of COVID-19 vaccines, offering the extra jab to anyone over the age of 60. The move comes as virus rates in Israel are on the increase. Linda Gradstein takes it from here.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett announced the decision to offer a third vaccine dose to anyone over 60 who received their last shot at least 5 months ago.
The decision was based on considerable research and analysis, as well as the rise in risk of the Delta variant wave. Israel has already vaccinated 2,000 immunosuppressed people with a third dose with no severe adverse events. And now we're rolling out a national third dose campaign.
An Israeli study showed effectiveness of the COVID vaccine declined from 95% to 80% or even less against the Delta variant. Neither the U.S. nor the EU has yet recommended a third shot, but most Israeli doctors say they do not believe it will do any harm. Dr. Ashraf Shalmon of the Israeli Health Ministry said it is not yet clear how long even a third vaccine will provide protection.
It seems that vaccines are not sufficient to give a very high protective level for a very long time without maybe having a third dose. Now, a third dose could create another boost of time, which serves for 6 months, 1 year or not, or it could behave as we see in other types of vaccines, for instance, some hepatitis vaccines and some other vaccines like papilloma, where a third boost will usually create a long-lasting immunity.
Israel has also brought back its green pass regulations, meaning residents will have to show proof of immunization or a negative coronavirus test to enter many public places, including concerts, restaurants, and gyms. The decisions come as infection rates in Israel continue to rise, with more than 2,000 new cases reported each day. The percentage of COVID tests coming back positive is now more than 3%, double the rate of just a few weeks ago. Israel was a leader in the vaccination campaign, and more than 60% of the population has received at least one dose. Now Israelis hope a third dose will enable them to deal with the Delta variant. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
And finally, once part of a balanced ecosystem, the number of native sea urchins in Australia is multiplying. Scientists have offered a solution, but will people find it palatable? VOA's Arash Arabasadi rounds us out.
Marine biologist Paul Carnell of Deakin University is on the front lines of war.
Sea urchins are moving through these reefs, sometimes in really dense fronts, almost like little armies moving along and clearing everything in their path.
Sea urchins eat seaweed and kelp, but lately, he tells the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, their appetite is out of control.
They're the forests of the ocean, and so if you lose those trees, if you lose the kelp, you lose all of the other biodiversity, but also the fisheries species in there as well.
To preserve kelp and seaweed, which Carnell says can recover, the number of sea urchins has to come way down. So scientists devised a strategy to take a bite out of the problem by calling on people to eat down the population. Sea urchin is a popular ingredient in Japanese cooking, but getting Australians to the table has so far been a tall order, says restaurateur Jessica Teo, speaking to AUBC.
Not many local Australians know about sea urchin, and when every time we tell them about sea urchin, they always say no.
Urchins have so far impacted as many as 500 hectares of reef in the Port Phillip Bay in Victoria State. Experts say stricter environmental standards and a series of droughts reduced the amount of kelp, which has sea urchins on the move from more sources of food. Scientists say the locally sourced species makes for an environmentally friendly ingredient, and Carnell says putting them on plates helps solve the problem of a booming population. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.